COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Israeli regime's military occupation, the wards of the Gaza ghetto, announced the decision to ease imports and exports into the Gaza. COGAT boasted of extending the permitted fishing area from 9 to 12 nautical miles off of Gaza's coast, still way short of the 20 nautical miles stipulated by the Oslo Accords of 1990s. The post, announcing the change on July 12th, stated the decision was made following the recent security calm and after requiring political approval. The entry and exit of goods at the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing would also be eased, COGAT added. The group said the providing of such services, which benefit civilians, is conditional on maintaining security stability. The Israeli rights group's Gisha said COGAT's proposal are nowhere near enough to meet Gaza's needs or mitigate the harm caused by the blockade. While the Israeli regime permitted the entry of medical equipment, fishing, school supplies, shoes and other items into Gaza, it is still barring thousands of materials, including construction equipment, raw materials and spare parts, Gisha reported recently. It can seem a foreign concept to many to even contemplate a siege or blockade. Some do not understand how exactly the Zionist regime's policies makes normal life impossible for Palestinians in Gaza, and even when it's not bombing it. The siege amounts to a war crime, Al-Mizan has said, since it is collective punishment of 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza, about half of whom are children. Earlier this month, Gaza's electricity distribution company reported that less than 55% of electricity needs were met. Electricity is available for an average of just 13 hours per day across Gaza this year, according to UN Monitoring Group, OCHA. And this number assumes that all electricity lines from the occupied territories are active, which Al-Mizan noted is rare. Many crucial services underpinning daily life are affected by electricity shortages, from waste treatment through water services to the health sector. The Israeli regime has also been barring the import of almost all raw materials and equipment for reconstruction, with some minor exceptions like paper and detergents, Al-Mizan said. The Zionist regime's bombing of residential neighborhoods in Gaza has completely destroyed the homes of 8,500 people, the group said. 1 in 8 Palestinians in Gaza are unable to repair damages caused by bombings to their homes due to the Zionist regime's refusal to allow reconstruction materials into the enclave. Gisha pointed to reports claiming that the Zionist regime is conditioning Gaza's reconstruction efforts on certain political negotiations with Hamas. Textiles, furniture, farming, and fishing are some of the major industries impacted by the ongoing shortages of material, according to Gisha. Even acquiring a mattress is now difficult, Al-Mizan said, because sponge factories cannot operate. Gaza's economy, already battered before the Israeli regime's assault, has been further devastated by the Zionist regime's latest aggression. Prices have risen in Gaza's market as a result of severe restrictions, as have job losses. Gaza already had one of the world's highest unemployment rates, around 50% even before the Zionist regime's latest offensive. This number is expected to rise. Gaza is facing unprecedented levels of poverty, says Al-Mizan, and the vast majority of residents, about 68%, are food insecure. During the recent assault by the Zionist regime, this regime also targeted 24 medical facilities in Gaza, according to a report by Al Mizan. And starting the second day of the assault and for its duration, the Zionist regime's military authorities refused to let any patient leave Gaza through the Erez checkpoint to receive treatment outside of the Gaza Strip. Al Mizan said several people died as a result. The Erez checkpoint is only one of the two points of entry and exit from Gaza, and the only one between Gaza and the occupied territories and the occupied West Bank. The Zionist regime has largely kept it closed, barring some exceptions, since March 2020 under the guise of the COVID-19 pandemic. The other is Egypt's heavily secured Rafah crossing, which is Gaza's only passage to the outside world, not directly controlled by the Zionist regime, but which is only open when it is open to passengers, not goods or for commerce. Egypt aids the Israeli regime in denying to Palestinians their freedom of movement in and outside of Gaza. This is the status quo of the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza, a nearly unlivable reality that Palestinians in the Strip return to after every round of Israeli regime bombing. Sometimes restrictions on imports and exports are tightened or loosened. Sometimes the permitted nautical miles off the Gaza shore are extended or reduced. But so long as the Israeli regime siege on Gaza continues, any drip feed changes will alleviate Palestinian suffering only in the very short term. Without any meaningful change to end the blockade, the violence of the status quo persists.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading, "Wake up Australia," and "Drain the Swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture. And they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ships sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, a Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with U.S.'s anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the U.S. has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what it is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, a truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has been housing unaccompanied alien children from the southern border at temporary facilities at military bases. And reports from child advocates and people who have worked, the facilities are harrowing. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nolan Rapport Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Migrant Children at Military Bases. What is Biden doing? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. U.S. President Joe Biden has been housing unaccompanied alien children from the southern border at temporary facilities at military bases, and reports from child advocates and people who have worked at the facilities are harrowing. Why is the U.S. housing migrant children at military bases, and why is it treating them so poorly? What does it portend for treatment of migrant children under the Biden administration? A surge in the appearance of unaccompanied alien children at the southern border has overwhelmed Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and HHS Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, making it very difficult to provide proper care for the children. The number of unaccompanied alien children apprehended at the border nearly doubled from 4,852 in December 2020, the last full month of the Trump administration, to 9,266 in February 2021, the first full month in Biden administration. It rose again to 18,723 in March, was 16,908 in April, 13,892 in May, and 15,018 in June. Two statutes in illegal settlement agreement require CBP to transfer unaccompanied alien children to ORR within 72 hours of their apprehension. This does not apply to children from contagious countries. ORR is responsible for the children's care until they can be placed with sponsors, usually family members who will maintain custody over them while they wait for an immigration hearing. ORR has licensed detention centers for unaccompanied alien children with a total of more than 13,500 beds, but the adjusted space requirements during the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of children it can place at its licensed detention facilities. And the demand for bed space has gone up. As of July 15th, there were approximately 14,920 unaccompanied alien children in ORR custody. At the end of May, the system-wide average length of time the children were spending in ORR's shelters was 35 days. Consequently, ORR had to set up emergency housing facilities. This has included military bases in Texas, Joint Base San Antonio in Lackland, and Fort Bliss in El Paso. Previous presidents also have had to resort to using military bases for detaining unaccompanied alien children. In fact, the Obama-Biden administration did it. According to the Congressional Research Service, nearly 16,000 unaccompanied alien children were housed at military bases between 2012 and 2017 because existing shelters were overwhelmed by the number of children being apprehended at the border. This time, however, Biden is one who is responsible for ensuring that the children will receive proper care, and he doesn't seem to be able to meet that responsibility. Biden set up a tent city at Fort Bliss in March. It has held as many as 4,500 boys and girls ages 13 to 17 in large tents, but it only had 790 children in July, all boys. It is capable of holding up to 10,000 children, which makes it the largest detention facility the U.S. regime has ever set up for housing migrant children. Unlike regular ORR detention facilities, Fort Bliss and other emergency centers do not have to have state licenses to certify that they can care for children. Representative Veronica Escobar, child advocates and contract workers have claimed that the Fort Bliss facility is poorly managed and that children in it are suffering. They say children wait for weeks without speaking to a caseworker who could connect them with a sponsor, that COVID-19, other infectious diseases, and lice are rampant, and that some contract caregivers lack adequate training to work with young children. The level of stress among the children has been so high that the government has had to monitor them for incidents of self-harm, panic attacks, and escape attempts. Pencils, pens, scissors, nail clippers, and regular toothbrushes have been kept out of the tents to prevent the children from using them to hurt themselves. In a letter dated on July 15, 2021, Earth Justice, the Hispanic Federation, Alianza Nacional do Campus, Green Latinos, and Labor Council for Latin American Advancement called for the immediate closure of the Fort Bliss Detention Center. Among other things, they claim that Fort Bliss is unsafe because the Army has failed to take the necessary steps to ensure that it will be free to toxic waste hazards. At least 80 contaminated sites have been identified at Fort Bliss. What's more, two contractors who worked at Fort Bliss from May 12, 2021 to June 2, 2021 filed a whistleblower complaint in July. They say that the tents are massive. Each one has between 1,000 and 1,500 beds. Moreover, they are dirty and often smell like a locker room, and the presence of numerous portable toilets produces a sewage odor. Although many children are housed in these tents for as long as 2 months, it appears, according to the whistleblower's complaint, that their bedding is never washed. The children apparently also do not have enough clean clothes and other things, which makes them reluctant to exercise or to bathe because they lack clean clothes to change into afterwards. Biden also set up a much smaller detention facility in a vacant dormitory at Joint Base San Antonio, Lackland, Texas. It had a capacity of only 372 beds for boys aged 13 to 17. Approximately 100 boys were put there on April 17, 2021. It was closed on June 30. The way migrant children have been treated at Fort Bliss makes one wonder how they are being treated at the rest of the detention facilities, especially the emergency centers that do not have to have state licenses. But what is worrying is that what happens to them when they leave the ORR detention facilities to stay with sponsors. How can Biden ensure that the sponsors will treat them properly when he can't ensure proper treatment while they're still in government custody?
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, worship in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Since the beginning of human history, worship has played a central role in people's lives. Devotion to a higher being continues to tie humanity together, despite differences in customs and a variety of beliefs. We often associate worship with specific religious acts performed to a deity, distinguish it from other facets of one's life. However, the concept of worship in Islam is all-encompassing, and it incorporates ritual worship as well as common daily tasks. In Islam, worship is the very purpose of our existence. God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, declares in the Holy Quran, the Holy Book of Islam, "I did not create mankind except to worship me." Muslims worship Allah, the creator and sustainer of the universe, out of love and submission. They believe that he is one God, which is known as Allah in Arabic, who is completely unique and only he deserves to be worshipped. So the philosophy of worship in Islam is not just actions that are done towards a deity, a super being, no. This is not what it's confined to. Worship in Islam has to do with your entire lifestyle, the way you live your life, the way you act, the way you speak, the way you interact with other people. This is all and can be all worship in Islam. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the concept of worship in Islam. And we said that it's not something that is limited to a few actions. Worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a concept that is much broader in its context and in its nature. Worshipping Allah is a comprehensive concept within Islam, along with traditional rituals such as praying, fasting, you know, so on and so forth. It also consists of any lawful action a person does with God consciousness and in the hopes of earning reward from Almighty Allah. Therefore, devoting oneself to God in Islam does not require a person to enter a place of worship, nor embrace monasticism. Rather, fulfilling this purpose of life is an active daily pursuit from the Islamic perspective. Hence, a Muslim can be engaged in worship throughout the day, be it at home, work, or anywhere else. As you can see, worship in Islam is a deeper concept. Let's look at some of the examples that we can think of. So let's say that you are spending time with your family. You are playing with your kids. But your intention is that you are loving your kids and playing with your kids and entertaining your kids for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because Allah wants you and expects from you that you take care of your kids, of your wife, of your family, of oppressed people in the society. You do it out of the sense of responsibility and for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that same action becomes a worship of Allah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The number of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. may have been undercounted by as much as 60%, researchers at the University of Washington have found. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Glenza, reporter. This article is published under the heading, COVID cases in U.S. may have been undercounted by 60%, study shows. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The number of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. may have been undercounted as much as 60%, researchers at the University of Washington have found. The study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences builds on research, which has found the number of reported cases represents only a fraction of the estimated total number of infections. It has important implications for how many Americans need to be vaccinated to stop outbreaks. The paper comes as a swath of states across the South and Midwest, especially Arkansas, Missouri, and Louisiana, experience outbreaks driven by Delta variant infections among unvaccinated people. There are all sorts of different data sources we can draw on to understand the COVID-19 pandemic, said Adrian Rafty, a professor of sociology and statistics at the University of Washington and senior author. But he said each source of data has its own flaws that would give a biased picture of what's really going on. What we want to do is to develop a framework that corrects the flaws in multiple data sources and draws on their strength to give us an idea of COVID-19 prevalence in a region, a state, or country as a whole. The study incorporated data on deaths, the number of tests administered each day, and the proportion that come back positive. Importantly, it also incorporated data from studies of people randomly sampled for COVID-19 in Indiana and Ohio. Random sample surveys provide a strong evidence of actual prevalence of a disease because they do not rely on people seeking out tests, which often fail to capture asymptomatic infections. Based on analysis of that data, Researchers found as many as 65 million Americans may have been infected. Official tallies put the number at about 33 million. The University of Washington researchers estimated that 60% of all cases were missed, with only one in every 2.3 cases counted in Indiana and Ohio. Recently, the COVID case count maintained by Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and commonly referred by media outlets stood at nearly 34.5 million. Undercounts can depend on the severity of the pandemic and the amount of testing in that state, said Nicholas J. Irons, study co-author and postdoctoral student. He said, if you have a state with severe pandemic but limited testing, the undercount can be very high and you're missing the vast majority of infections that are occurring. Or you could have a situation where testing is widespread and the pandemic is not as severe. There, the undercount rate would be lower. The findings have important implications for the prospect of reaching herd immunity, the point at which outbreaks end because the virus cannot find new hosts. As of May, scientists believe the herd immunity threshold for COVID-19 to be around 80%, a number that has edged upward with the emergence of highly contagious variants such as Delta. By the spring of 2021, the study indicates about 20% of the U.S. population had been infected with COVID-19. Without a mass vaccination campaign, the findings indicate the U.S. would be unlikely to reach herd immunity anytime soon and therefore likely to suffer waves of outbreaks, hospitalizations, and deaths. Even with a mass vaccination campaign, the U.S. is unlikely to reach herd immunity this year or perhaps ever because of highly contagious variants, low vaccine acceptance in some states, and because children under 12 are not eligible for vaccines. About 56% of Americans are fully vaccinated, but those inoculations are not evenly spread. Northeastern states tend to have administered the highest proportion of vaccines, and states in the South and Midwest the lowest. That uneven distribution has allowed an outbreak of Delta infections to sweep through unvaccinated people across Arkansas, Missouri, and Louisiana. Vaccines currently authorized in the U.S. are effective only against one type of variant. Low vaccination rates, including among health workers in the U.S., have in turn sparked a national debate on vaccine mandates, with hospital chains and major city governments beginning to institute mandates for workers to be vaccinated. The American Medical Association issued a joint statement with dozens of doctors and nurses groups calling for mandatory vaccination of health workers. Elder care workers in particular have among the lowest vaccination rates in the medical industry across the United States. More than 40% have yet to receive a shot.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Formulating and implementing the theory of the Islamic Republic was Imam's great achievement. Our magnanimous Imam's great accomplishment was that he created this thought and this theory, the theory of the Islamic Republic, and brought it to the arena where various political theories existed. At that time, different political theories in the East and the West clashed with one another over political matters and outlooks. And he subsequently implemented and realized that theory. He did not just formulate theory, he executed it as well. And this way, he brought the Islamic Republic into existence. That was Imam's great achievement. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah. Imam's deep understanding of Islam and deep trust in the people helped him formulate and execute the theory of the Islamic Republic. Well, Imam, may God the Exalted bestow paradise on him, was a great man in many different ways, one of which was his religious knowledge and understanding, the source of support for creating that theory and then putting it into practice was on the one hand his deep understanding of Islam. He knew Islam and he knew that Islamic governance was the main message of Islam. On the other hand was his deep faith in the people. He had tremendous faith in the people. He believed in their capabilities, willpower and loyalty, and we have an abundance of memories about his astonishing faith in them. In the solar year 1341, when the movement had just started, in one class he steered the discussion towards political matters and the most important affair of the country. He pointed to the desert in Qom, saying that if we at that time asked the people, they would have filled the desert. In the solar calendar 1341, no one would have thought that it would be possible to make the people join the cause. Imam would think that the two parts of the theory of the Islamic Republic, both its Islamic and Republic aspect, originated from Islam. His theory was based on Islam. Actually, it was his mastery over Islamic teachings and his deep and comprehensive understanding of Islamic lessons that crafted the theory in the mind of that great personality.
That you've done.
around the world with reporters.
Two times Prime Minister Najib Mikati has been given the task of forming a Lebanese cabinet for the third time. After officially being appointed by President Michel Aoun, Mikati stressed that he needs the confidence of the people, not only the lawmakers.
To stop the inferno, we all need to cooperate together. I know this is a difficult task, but I have my mind set. If I didn't have necessary foreign reassurances, I would have not taken this step.
While stressing openness to all factions, Mikati also noted that the new government will be formed, quote, according to the French initiative, for the interest of Lebanon and its economy. 72 members of parliament endorsed Mikati, including Hezbollah's loyalty to the resistance bloc.
Since the resignation of Hassan Diop's government in August 2020, the loyalty to resistance bloc has called for the formation of a government in order to facilitate the country's affairs. We have always dealt very positively with all the efforts, and with the emergence of signs pointing to the possible formation of a government, we have voted for Najib Mikati.
Experts believe the rhetoric with which Mikati has begun his task is that of openness, and therefore could pave the way for more flexible talks with all sides.
Prime Minister Mikati has clearly said he has foreign guarantees, and he also said there are no preconditions from any of the partners in the country. So this is a new method of dealing with things in Lebanon, would entail that all sides deal positively with this formation, since they all want a way out of the crisis in light of a looming security calamity if the crisis persists.
Mikati, who seems to have the support of the United States and France, has claimed he can stop the economic and financial collapse, which has worsened since October 2019. The designation of Najib Mikati as prime minister was calm and prompt. However, what lies ahead will be much more tumultuous, whether it is the formation process or facing the multifaceted crisis in Lebanon. Mariam Saleh from the Presidential Palace in Baabda.
People have been displaced from their homes after Taliban captured the Shia-dominated district of Mahlistan in central Ghazni province. They say the Taliban committed war crimes by killing tens of civilians.
We were in the region during the first two nights of the Taliban attack, but were forced to leave our homes. The Taliban forced us to provide them with food and drink. They also killed about 40 innocent civilians.
The recent Taliban advances across Afghanistan have brought heavy consequences for local Afghans, especially those who live in remote districts and villages. The Mahlistan in west of Ghazni province is one among attacked regions by the Taliban over the past weeks.
We call on the government to retake our district and secure the roads connecting Mahlistan to the provincial capital city of Ghazni. We, the people of Mahlistan, are the part of Afghan nation, and the government is responsible to provide us the security.
Taliban has dismissed any reports on killing of civilians in the Mahlistan region. Fighting between the Taliban and Afghan government forces has increased over the past months as foreign troops leave the country. The Taliban has made rapid gains, retaking border crossings and rural areas. The government has stepped up operations to push back the militants. Figures show that at least 3,000 people have been displaced from Mahlistan district over the last 10 days following Taliban attacks there. Displaced residents say government forces did not resist those attacks as they had expected. This, as Afghan officials have repeatedly claimed that troops were tactically retreated from dozens of districts, including Mahlistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.